journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Thursday, October 30th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar.
It just makes me stop and think. Silence is not an option.
An alternative look at Prop 8. A young woman discusses her two dads. And journalism professor Robert Jensen on the elections and his new documentary, The Price of Pleasure.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. As we head closer to the elections, Proposition 8, the same-sex marriage ban, hovers on the brink of passing. Massive amounts of money have been poured into passing the measure, particularly by the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Thousands of gay couples who tied the knot after the state Supreme Court decision early this summer to allow same-sex marriage are now apprehensive of the legal limbo they could be in if the measure passes. The scare tactics from the Yes on 8 campaign have continued in the form of political ads declaring that gay marriage, among other things, will be taught in schools if the proposition fails. But rarely do we hear the personal stories of families in the middle of this ideological battle. Today we meet a young woman who is personally affected by Proposition 8, Sarah Gogan. She's a local member of Collage, which is a national movement of children, youth and adults who, with one or more gay parents. Welcome to Uprising, Sarah.
Hi, how are you?
Doing very well. Thanks very much for joining us. So you are the child of two dads.
Yes.
And you were based in San Francisco, grew up in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
Which may be a safer place to grow up in within that kind of within a family unit that is with two gay parents in San Francisco rather than in any other country. But tell our listeners a little bit about what it was like growing up and what you went through, particularly when you went to school.
Growing up for me was, I guess, like all of my friends, pretty normal. My parents took me to school. My parents were members of the school board, were coaches for soccer and baseball. And everything was really, it was great growing up. I never really dealt with any adversity going to grammar school. My parents kind of came out for our entire family since kindergarten. I went through to a K through 8 grammar school. It was Catholic school. And you'd think going to a Catholic school, things would be a lot harder, but we're pretty liberal in our school. All they taught was just, you know, to love everybody no matter what the difference was. And but I think going to high school, it got a little bit more difficult for me. In high school, you know, kids are in puberty and they're starting to feel different things or they're starting to learn more, you know, slang words and start to use those types of hateful words. And it got a little bit more difficult. Couple times there were kids who would say things to me like, oh, your family's not a real family, or they would call me names, direct, like they were more directed towards my parents, but then they would like direct it towards me. And it was a little difficult, even though growing up in San Francisco, you know, I probably was blessed with a more accepting community than a lot of other communities.
How long have your parents been together?
They met 36 years ago and have been together for 22 years.
And, you know, this is the type of story we don't hear very often. How do you respond to people who very sincerely believe that if same-sex couples are allowed to get married, that it threatens their own marriage?
That it threatens their, mm-hmm. like the couple's...
That it threatens heterosexual marriage. Mm. That somehow threatens the very institution of traditional marriage.
Well, I don't see how it would threaten it. It's not like we're saying, oh, well, now that gay marriage is legal, like, you have to agree with gay marriage. Like, all gay marriage is giving equal opportunity to any couple who's in love and who wants to be together. And it shouldn't threaten anybody. All it's allowing is other people to get married. I don't see how it would threaten another couple. Like, Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, there's this, I want to play for our listeners the new ad against a rather for Prop 8 that has been put out. This is part of the series of advertisements that have in recent weeks been released across the state of California and has actually led to a dramatic increase in the support of Proposition 8 from earlier in the summer. Let's take a listen to what this particular advertisement says, and then we'll get your response, sir.
Opponents of Proposition 8 said gay marriage has nothing to do with schools. Then a public school took first graders to a lesbian wedding, calling it a teachable moment. Now a liberal education politician says schools aren't required to teach about marriage, yet his official website confirms teaching marriage is required in 96% of schools. And a leading Prop 8 opponent has warned parents cannot remove children from this instruction. Children will be taught about gay marriage unless we vote yes on Proposition 8.
And that is just one of the advertisements urging people to vote yes on Proposition 8. My guest is Sarah Gogan. How do you respond to that?
First of all, the whole Prop 8 is not saying that we're going to be teaching about homosexuality or we're going to be forcing people to believe that that they have to believe in gay marriage or have to believe in homosexuality in general. The only thing that Prop 8 really is doing is allowing for equal opportunity. That's all that it's
you
really
mean enough. Well, Proposition 8 allows the state constitution to be amended. So if it were to fail, then the current law allowing same-sex marriage, according to the Supreme Court decision, would stand. Yeah. So it's a simple proposition, actually. I mean, the proposition just wants the state constitution to be amended. And if it were to be amended, then the Supreme Court, of course, couldn't take a decision on it. But if it does pass, then it amends the Constitution, and then, you know, there's certainly no provision in that about anything to be taught or not taught in schools. Let's talk, Sarah, a little bit about how you have been responded to in your conversations, in the campaigning that you have done against Proposition 8. How have people responded to you?
I've been doing a lot, actually, for my school. Right now, I also go to a Catholic school, and so one of the major issues is Catholicism and beliefs and how is Prop 8 going to affect, you know, the Catholic Church and everything. And so I've been getting a lot of negative feedback, I guess, from people who are part of the Catholic Church saying that, oh, well, you're going to be, you know, forcing us to believe something. Or also the thing with Prop 8 is that it's not – it's not instituting it into a church. There is the separation between church and state. And so I guess the thing that, you know, the way I've been handling it is just telling people, you know, it's not going to be telling you this is what you have to believe in, but more so just allowing for a marriage.
Now, your two parents got married this past August.
Yes.
And what was that like? You gave them away, I understand.
Yes, I did. It was a beautiful ceremony. Not a dry eye in the audience, that's for sure. We were just surrounded by a lot of people who have supported us over the years, supported my family when people have said things against us. But it was beautiful because it wasn't just a marriage. It was more of a celebration of, you know, how many years they've been together. 22 years is a long time to be with somebody.
Yes.
And as my dad always tells me, it's, you know, they don't need, like, witnesses to tell them that they're married. They don't need, like, a paper or rings or a wedding. For them, it was really just a way to show other people, you know, thank you for supporting us and thank you for being my life partner. You know, it's not like it wasn't really – they didn't need the marriage is what they said. But the fact is that to have the ability to marry, it just gave them more of like a sigh of relief that now they are being accepted into society.
My guest is Sarah Gogan. She's talking to us about her family and how Proposition 8 could affect her and her two parents if it does pass. And by the way, I want to announce a new feature on our website this morning that we have allowed, we've put in place in order to allow you to give us feedback during the show. It's our live instant feedback feature that we have just put on our website, and you can find that at kpfk.org/uprising. If you go to kpfk.org, www.facebook.com/uprising. Click on the button that says live feedback in the right-hand column. And if you want to participate in this conversation, if you have questions for Sarah and for our guests coming up in the rest of this hour, you can take part in the conversation by posting your questions or comments. And if they're relevant, I will certainly try to read them out on the air. Again, that's kpfk.org/uprising. So, Sarah, you yourself are engaged to be married right now. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I have a boyfriend right now.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I see. This is, you know, how do you respond when people say that that the children of gay parents, their own sexuality is affected, that it's somehow this sort of infectious disease?
Yeah, that, I definitely get that a lot. I am straight. I do have a boyfriend. And the thing is that I think having two dads or having gay parents in general, it really just opens your eyes to difference in general. If my parents are gay, and then they'll accept whoever I am, and it just kind of opens doors. Whereas I think that's where people maybe get the idea that, oh, if you have gay parents, like, you're going to turn out to be gay. No, like, having gay parents, like, they gave me the option. You know, if you're gay, then that's completely fine with us. If you're straight, bi, whatever, you know, that's completely fine. Like, I think it just, Yeah.
Tell us about this organization. You're a member of COLLAGE, C-O-L-A-G-E, this national movement.
Yeah, COLLAGE stands for Children of Lesbians and Gays Everywhere. It's an organization that it's nationally based, and it's a place for kids to come around and just kind of talk about their stories and their experiences with their families. And they also do a lot of media outreach to people in schools, to either allies or people who are opposed to either homosexuality in general or to gay marriage. So it's a great organization because it was a way for me to meet people who were like me, because going to a Catholic school, there weren't a lot of kids who had gay parents. So COLLAGE was a way for me to meet other people. Mm. As well as tell my story and hope that other people could learn from it.
You know, going back to this scare tactic about, gay marriage is going to be taught in school if Prop 8 fails, you know, it's interesting when you think about it, because it's not as though if gay people aren't allowed to get married that they're just going to go away. I mean, gay relationships will continue, loving mm-hmm. relationships will continue, and homosexuality exists whether you acknowledge it or not. Mm-hmm. What do you think that children should be exposed to different types of families, different varieties of family and family units, and that it shouldn't just be the sort of traditional father, mother, two children, or, you know, however many children, idea that we have in our heads, that it really should be something that children should be exposed to, because that's life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I completely agree that no matter what, there's always going to be gay couples, as you said. So why not teach about it in schools? Why not at least just teach people about difference? It's not saying that you have to be gay or you have to believe in, you know, homosexuality, but it's just saying that, yeah, we should teach difference in school.
And maybe if that had happened earlier, if that had been happening over the decades, you might have faced an easier time in school.
Probably, yeah.
with kids' awareness being raised. I mean, and that has, you know, whether or not Proposition 8 passes, even if Proposition 8 does pass, homosexuality, is something that certainly can be discussed, certainly in schools, and should be, you know, and it's almost a separate issue, I think, from whether or not marriage is allowed, mm-hmm. and opens the door for discussion. Where can listeners find out more, Sarah, about the organization that you're a member of, if they're in a similar position or if they'd like to help out?
You could help out on online. Actually, there's places to make donations online, or you could email. It's www.collage.org.
That's collage.org. Let me, in fact, announce our very first question on our live instant feedback. Carlos from, I guess he didn't say where he was from. One of our listeners has commented saying, as a child of a married gay couple, how do you think it has served your perspective in life and the Mormon Church, which I understand is against gay marriage? What is your perspective? You know, how has it changed your perspective on the church, this Mormon church that's fueling the fight against gay marriage?
It's not really it's not really changed my perspective on the church. I am a Catholic, so I'm still going to be a Catholic no matter what. I guess I just choose the teachings that in the Catholic Church that I want to believe in. I believe in preaching love. I believe in acceptance, and I believe in the teachings like that of Jesus. That you know everyone should be taken care of, and everyone should be equally loved. And so. So I don't think that's really changed my view on the Catholic Church. I don't really know much about the Mormon Church. So,
Finally, Sarah, what do you think your parents are going to do if Proposition 8 does pass?
I continue living how they were living before.
I mean, it sort of puts them in a legal limbo, of course.
But. Yeah, I mean, nothing's going to really affect the adoption for us. They did adopt me separately. So it's not going to change that. It's not going to change the fact that they're living together or anything on the house or whatever. They're still going to be together. It's just going to be sad, though, that if it is passed, that my parents, basically, like, their happy day and their rights are taken away.
Sarah Gogan, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Sarah Gogan is a local member of Collage, a national movement of children, youth, and adults with one or more gay parents. Her two parents got married in August after the Supreme Court of this state overturned an earlier proposition that banned gay marriage. You are listening to Uprising, and we're going to take a short break with today's subversive historian. When we come back, Robert Jensen, journalism professor and author, will join us in studio for the rest of the hour. We'll be talking to him about this year's elections, whether elections do really matter, and we'll also find out about his brand new documentary, The Price of Pleasure. Stay tuned.
If your family car is more of a trick than a treat, you can donate it to the KPFK Vehicle Donation Program. You won't have to deal with scary people coming by your house to look at your car by calling 877-KPFK-AUTO. We'll take care of everything from picking up your vehicle to sending you the final paperwork. The number is 877-KPFK-AUTO, AUTO. Or donate online at kpfk.org, then click on the link that reads Pledge Support.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. 58 years ago, on this day in people's history, the Jayuya Uprising took hold on the island of Puerto Rico. On the morning of October 30, 1950, Blanca Canales of the Nationalist Party led an armed rebellion to liberate Puerto Rico from U.S. colonialism and declare its independence. Pedro Albizu Campos and other nationalists hastened their uprising after uncovering plans by the U.S. to deal a fatal blow to the independence movement to avoid the coming crackdown. The nationalists launched their attack in the town of Jayuya, strategically located in the central mountains. Canales' forces routed the police and took control as the rebellion spread throughout the island. The U.S. response through the colonial government was to suppress the rebellion through successful bombing campaigns. Trying to portray the conflict as an internal matter, the U.S. imposed a media blackout on the events unfolding. The news of the day can be stifled, but the truth of history has its own way of rising up. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our history.
Welcome back to Uprising. More than 35,000 people attended a late-night Florida rally to see Barack Obama and former President Bill Clinton yesterday. Millions of people are estimated to have already voted in early voted in states across the nation, and turnout is already breaking previous records, particularly among African Americans and young people. It is these demographics that Barack Obama's campaign has especially reached out to, hoping to elect the nation's first black president. Yesterday, the Obama campaign aired a 30-minute paid advertisement on seven major TV networks simultaneously in a final push to make his case for the presidency. The presidential race has been the most expensive in the nation's history. Meanwhile, the McCain-Palin camp has also been furiously getting their message out to voters, denouncing a new Obama ad critical of Palin, and challenging the LA Times to release a video of Obama attending a dinner where he praised Rashid Khalidi, a prominent Palestinian activist and scholar who we've had on our program in the past. With just days left before the election, we have a conversation today with Robert Jensen, professor of journalism and author of several books, including The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism and White Privilege, and Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity. He's also the senior consultant for a new documentary called The Price of Pleasure, Pornography, Sexuality, and Relationships. Welcome to Uprising, Bob Jensen.
Good to be back with you, Sonali.
Thanks so much for joining us. And we will be discussing your documentary in the second part of this conversation. I want to focus on elections first. So, you know, many are calling, as I said, this is a historic election, not only, of course, in terms of the candidacy, but as a result of that, in terms of the turnout. It seems as though states are having a hard time coping with more than, a certain number of people voting in this country. Are you caught up in the Obama mania, if you will?
Well, I would say it's a historic election and a relatively trivial election all at the same time. Certainly, the possibility that the United States of America, which only came out of formal apartheid within my lifetime, the possibility that this country, still very much a white supremacist country in both material realities and ideology, that we might elect a person of African descent for the presidency is really quite striking. It's also trivial in the sense that the structures of power, the institutions in which that power operates, are not going to significantly change. Barack Obama has made no suggestion that he brings with him a progressive, let alone a radical agenda. So what we see is that the system maintains itself. It's flexible. It allows change of a very limited sort. And that change can be meaningful in different kinds of ways. But as we are on the brink of multiple crises in this culture, I think we also have to step back and realize how this election, in some sense, is not that important.
Hmm. Now, isn't progressive relative in light of the Bush administration's agenda? Isn't what Barack Obama at least says he's going to do pretty significant compared to Bush and compared to what McCain says he would do, which is essentially a continuation of Bush?
Well, yeah, of course, all these terms are relative. You know, good-looking is a term relative. You know, if I'm the standard, well, then, you know, a lot of people are good-looking. But that's not really the point. Barack Obama is part of the machine that is the Democratic Party. If you look at the two things that might indicate where he will take the country, that is his own statements and the advisors around him, I see no reason to think that there's any progressive core to the Obama candidacy, nor will there be to an Obama presidency. Now, that can be taken as a sort of depressing fact about the rightward shift in the United States that's gone on now for 20 or 30 years, the end of the New Deal coalition, all sorts of things that Obama is inheriting. But the fact is, Obama himself has not stated any intention to take this country to the left, and he has not chosen an advisors that one would believe would be part of that. So the point remains, electoral politics in the United States at this moment, from my point of view, is not where the action is. That is, for those of us who might consider ourselves political activists, have a progressive, left, radical, feminist agenda, there's a lot of work to do. I'm not suggesting that all is lost, there's nothing to do. I'm suggesting that we have to ask, where are we most likely to get traction? Where are we most likely to do work that will be productive over the long term? And I think at this point, the election is mostly a diversion. I'll be very glad when it's over, simply to go back to work without that distraction.
If you'd like to join the conversation, go to kpfk.org/uprising and click on live feedback on the right-hand side of our website. It's our new feature this morning that we're introducing this morning. And if you, particularly if you are an Obama supporter and you'd like to ask a question of my guest, Robert Jensen, who says that the election is a distraction, we need to get back to work, give put out your comments and questions on our website and we will ask them on the air if they're relevant. Again, kpfk.org/uprising. It's instant feedback, and I'm checking the questions here right now, so you can submit your questions and comments, and I'll be able to see them right away. Again, kpfk.org/uprising. Well, Professor Jensen, let me put this out again. Here we have a person in the White House and the person who wants to follow him saying that they want to continue the tax cuts on the rich at a time when our economy economy is completely falling apart. And then you have another person who is saying he wants to let the tax cuts expire and he wants to provide tax cuts for the majority of working class and middle class people. That's a pretty specific difference. That's not subjective like someone's good looks. That's actually pretty objective. Is that not something that can have traction, particularly for ordinary people, and actually can make a difference in some people's lives? Even if change happens in the margins, it's better than no change.
Yeah, no, I'm not arguing against voting for Obama. I voted early, and I voted both in the primary and the general election for Barack Obama without any hesitation. It's clear that over time, in the modern era, Democratic candidates have been generally supportive of programs that benefit ordinary folks. So in that sense, yes. The question is, where are we at politically, economically, ecologically, and culturally at this moment in history? And is it, in fact, adequate to believe that simply changing the leadership within the existing system can take us out of the crises we're in and into a just and sustainable future? My answer is no. It doesn't mean that the differences in policy between the two candidates are irrelevant. They are relevant in some ways. My concern is that, much like in 1992, when after 12 years of right-wing Republican rule, the United States elected a nominally progressive candidate, Bill Clinton, much of the progressive activism dissipated after that. This example has been used often. If we return to that project of electing a progressive candidate, or at least someone who, relative to the right-wing reactionary center of American politics, looks more progressive, and then ignore the real work of building movements and institutions at the ground level, then I fear we will have a repeat of 8 years of Bill Clinton, which took this country further to the right. Bill Clinton pushed the country further to the right than it was when he was elected. And there's a possibility Barack Obama could do the same thing. I think especially we have to look beyond just questions about tax cuts and look at the basic neoliberal program in economics and the way in which the Obama campaign has not significantly suggested a departure from that. Naomi Klein wrote a very good piece in The Nation some weeks ago called Obama's Chicago Boys. That is, his economic advisors, the people around him shaping that policy, are very much from this neoliberal school of thought associated with the University of Chicago.
My guest is Robert Jensen, a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about the elections, and I want to play for you an excerpt of the paid commercial, 30-minute commercial that Barack Obama had on airing on 7 networks simultaneously yesterday, and get your response to that.
America, the time for change has come. And to all of you and all of those who've joined us from across the country, in 6 days, we can choose an economy that rewards work and creates jobs and fuels prosperity, starting with the middle class. In 6 days, we can choose to invest in health care for our families, and education for our kids, and renewable energy for our future. In 6 days, we can choose hope over fear, and once more choose our better history.
And that is an excerpt from yesterday's 30-minute commercial that Barack Obama aired. This was part of the live rally that they went to. A lot of talk of inspiring hope. Bob Jensen, you brought up a very interesting point, I think, about comparing this to Clinton. Now, certainly it looks like Barack Obama, if he is elected, will likely be elected with an even greater majority, even more votes from young people, from people of color, than Bill Clinton was. And perhaps have even more invested in him, emotionally invested in him, these sort of hopes and inspiration that people are putting out there. And do you think this is a result of the eight? Do you think people have just been so traumatized by Bush that this is sort of this easy way, this one act that doesn't require them to take on activism as a daily struggle?
Yeah, I think there's actually an important parallel that you've just pointed out. One is, let's look at politics as marketing. Many people have pointed out we really don't have elections anymore. We have contests between advertising agencies. Well, here's Barack Obama promising change. He is the candidate of change. How do we know this? Because we're told over and over again he's the candidate of change. name, I would be interested if anyone could name one significant change, that is a meaningful change in the direction of the country that Barack Obama has suggested. Has he suggested that we pull back from an imperial position in the world and respect the basic tenets of international law? No, in fact, he argues that we can ignore them just like other presidents have. Has he suggested that the fundamental underpinnings of this neoliberal project are bankrupt and need to be rethought? No, he's just suggesting different ways to tweak economic policy. Some of those tweakings matter. I'm not arguing they don't. I'm not arguing that the possibility we will elect a black president is irrelevant. I'm suggesting that real progressive political change does not come in the electoral realm in the system we live in. And I do think that much like his campaign is a marketing campaign, people are acting like consumers, like I can just go buy the Obama brand and feel good. Well, the fact is the real work of politics is very difficult. It's long struggles for change, building institutions that can bring that change. I think paradoxically, it's those struggles which can be so difficult that actually provide, for me at least, the real meaning in life. It's the people I meet in those struggles. For instance, I live in Austin, Texas, and I'm working with a group of young people to try and establish some new worker-owned businesses. Well, that's not, you know, the flashy business of politics that we're seeing on our TV screens. That's the real work of trying to build alternatives to a predatory corporate capitalism. And it is work, but it's also a sense of, a source of great joy. And I think that the danger here is that the marketing campaign that is Barack Obama is selling at some basic level the illusion that political change comes from simply buying his product, buying the Obama brand. And I think young people will be very disappointed when they realize that isn't going to bring that change.
And it uses language, you know, it uses the terms the movement, which is, you know, is a form of co-optation, certainly.
Theft. Let's just call it what it is. The Barack Obama campaign and the Democratic Party are not a movement. Movements are when people, ordinary people, come together to shape their own destiny. Democracy is rooted in movements where ordinary people have a chance to meaningfully participate, not just in the election of one set of elites over another, but to meaningfully participate in the formation of public policy. The Democratic Party is not a movement.
My guest is Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, author of several books, including The Heart of Whiteness, Confronting Race, Racism, and White Privilege, and Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, also Getting Off Pornography and the End of Masculinity. We are going to be discussing in the second part of this conversation his new documentary that he's a senior consultant for called The Price of Pleasure, Pornography, Sexuality, and Relationships. In the meantime, let's continue our discussion on the elections. Now, what about the argument that if Barack Obama were to be the progressive, perfect, ideal candidate, there's no way he'd get elected?
That's true. And that just points to the utter bankruptcy of the contemporary electoral system. I'm not suggesting that I wish Barack Obama had stood up, and you mentioned Rashid Khalidi, and advocated open support for the justice of the Palestinian cause. To do that would be political suicide in the electoral arena. That points not to some holier-than-thou critique of Barack Obama. It points to the limits of the electoral system. If there were movements on the ground in the United States that were pushing positions for peace and justice, like the Palestinian cause, then politicians would respond. Again, my point is not to beat up on Barack Obama unnecessarily. Quite frankly, I find him a very engaging character. I like people who are intelligent and articulate. I prefer intelligent or articulate people to the alternative. It's not a critique of him or the choices he's made. He's making choices within a system. My argument is that we have to keep our eye on the nature of that system. And in my lifetime, I'm 50 years old, I've seen the possibilities within the electoral system atrophy year after year. That is, maybe in 1972, when George McGovern was running, there was a reason to think that that election could shift the course of U.S. history. I don't think that's the case today. Whatever the Obama candidacy means, and again, I want to emphasize, I think it means some things that are very positive. It is not, I think, reasonable to expect it will change the direction of U.S. politics. That's got to come on the ground. And I think part of the reason people are investing so much hope in Barack Obama and that campaign is because on the ground, things don't look so good.
Right.
We are looking at multiple crises in this country that are at levels that we can no longer, I think, ignore. an economic crisis, not just the last month or two in the financial meltdown, but an economy that is in, I think, permanent decline, an economy that never met the needs of real human beings, and that problem both internally and worldwide exacerbated today. A political crisis. Very few people feel that the system is meaningfully democratic. And, of course, an overarching ecological crisis in which I think we have to come to terms with the fact that the health of the ecosystem on every important measure is in decline, which means that if we continue in the system in which we live today, a fundamentally unsustainable system, we are looking at not centuries, but perhaps decades in which the standard at which we live in the West today is not only going to be unacceptable morally, but unacceptable ecologically. These are all very, very dire situations, and it's much easier to believe that shifting people around at the national political level can change that. I don't think it can.
If you'd like to join the conversation, you can do so online at kpfk.org/uprising. That's kpfk.org/uprising. Just click on the link that says click here to join the conversation now, and you can post a question or comment that we'll certainly be happy to read out on the air to my guest, Robert Jensen. So, Bob Jensen, the Green Party, the Peace and Freedom Party, all of these third parties might say to you, well, the real alternative to sort of destroying the two-party deadlock on our political system is to vote for a third party. You said you voted for Barack Obama. How do you respond to the third party way of changing things question?
Well, of course, in the short term, voting for a third party, if one, especially one, lives in a swing state, I think is ill-advised. The question is not in this election, do I vote third party for, you know, or Democrat. I personally voted for Barack Obama because I believe the symbolic gesture of a white supremacist society overcoming, at least at this particular moment, some parts of that white supremacist history and present reality, and electing a person of African descent is a profound moment. I also think that we, again, have to take that in the context of a really set of cascading crises we have to address. I don't think a voting third party is a meaningful act either.
I want to challenge the issue of the symbolic vote, you know, so voting to in terms of it being important symbolically. I mean, what if we're talking about a black Republican? What if it was Colin Powell or Condoleezza Rice or any number of other black Americans who were running with the Republican Party? Would your choice have still been the same?
No. I personally, there are limits within which I can stomach this. This is not an acceptance of what I think is a very superficial notion of racial politics. It says all that matters is the color of one's skin. I think the fact that Barack Obama at least articulates some sort of liberal progressive message puts it in the ballpark. No, I personally wouldn't vote for Condoleezza Rice. I wouldn't vote for Colin Powell. I would advocate that they be held accountable under international law and be tried on war crimes and crimes against peace, a whole other discussion.
Sure.
So I think all of this has to go forward realistically, you know, looking at the system we live in, the way in which people of color sometimes make choices to represent the worst aspects of that system. I'm not suggesting a kind of naive vote in that sense. But I do think there is something important about this particular moment, especially since we've seen the resurgence of not just a kind of subtle and covert racism, but open racism in opposition to Barack Obama. We can't ignore the fact that around this country there are people apparently without shame stating openly that they will not vote for him on the basis of race. So in that sense, I do think there is something important going on around white supremacy in this election.
And I want to read out another listener's comment. A person calling themselves a KPFK supporter says, the current administration has been so damaging and secretive that it has caused too many in the U.S. to have a negative outlook on our future. Something new is about to happen if we can keep certain racist factions in check. Senator Obama, when elected, will not be able to solve all the problems by himself. It's going to take everyone in this country who are serious about change participating in the good that this man will spearhead. Thank you for that comment. And you can join the conversation online at kpfk.org/uprising. And my guest is Robert Jensen. Before we take a short break and move on to the documentary part of this conversation, I want to also announce we have an online poll. And Bob Jensen, you might be interested in the results of this poll. The question was, if Obama is elected president, how hopeful are you that he will institute many of the changes he has promised? The winner is 39% is very hopeful. Obama is the next FDR. Second highest is somewhat hopeful. He's better than McCain. Many folks have said that's only 19% of the voters said indifferent. Bush, McCain, Obama, what's the difference? And then 11% said mildly hopeful. Anyone's better than Bush. you are listening to Uprising. My guest is Robert Jensen. We're going to take a short break, and Bob will stay with us to the end of the hour. When we come back, we'll talk about the new documentary that he's a senior consultant on. It's being distributed by the Media Education Foundation. It's called The Price of Pleasure, Pornography, Sexuality, and Relationships.
KPFK would like to thank you, the listener, for your continued support, contributing to our recent fund drive. Thanks to you, we can continue free of corporate advertising and underwriting. And remember, you can always become a member online at kpfk.org. Coming up after Uprising, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman at 9. Stay with us.
Tonight, we are going to take you into the parallel universe of pornography in America today. It's now an estimated $10 billion business, which is bigger than the NFL, NBA, and Major League Baseball combined. More than all the tickets spent at movie theaters. Some of the most respected corporations in America are making millions from it, while saying nothing publicly at all.
With estimated annual revenues of $10 to $14 billion, the pornography industry has developed close ties with telecommunication and media corporations. Time Warner, CBS, and News Corp collectively earn $1 billion annually from pornography, either by directly distributing pornography through video on demand, or by producing and licensing porn-related content and cross-promoting it through their various media holdings. Pornography production, once considered exploitative, is now depicted as a fun and normal business.
And those are some of the opening moments of the new documentary, The Price of Pleasure, Pornography, Sexuality, and Relationships. With the nomination of Sarah Palin as the Republican vice presidential candidate, a significant surge of activity on the internet focusing on sexist male fantasies of the Alaska governor have appeared. Hustler's Larry Flint is already peddling a new porn video about Palin, and no one in the news media seems concerned enough to cover it as a news story. Even McCain's own camp has not seen fit to denounce it. Pornography, once relegated to the margins of society, as we heard in the documentary, is now being accepted as mainstream. And at the same time, according to the filmmakers of the documentary that we just heard from, the content of pornography has become more aggressive, more overtly sexist and racist. My guest is Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. He's written several books, including Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, and Getting Off Pornography and the End of Masculinity. He served as senior consultant to this documentary. Let's talk about this film, Bob, that I know that you've been working on for quite a while now with your co-filmmakers.
Yes, it's actually a project that started here in L.A. when we visited the offices of Hustler magazine.
Through this very program.
Indeed it was. I remember it well, Sonali. When we were talking about this issue, I believe in the aftermath of the Abu Ghraib scandal and the pornographic sexualized nature of some of those pictures of torture, making some of the connections, and that, of course, pushes a lot of buttons in this culture.
And that's right. We had a conversation, a debate between a person who worked at Hustler and yourself, and there was just a lot of interesting things that happened out of that conversation. And now we have a documentary, which I'm very happy to be featuring here on this program. It's called The Price of Pleasure, Pornography, Sexuality, and Relationships. And Bob Jensen, when we say that pornography has become mainstream, you know, some would argue, well, so what? What's wrong with that?
Yeah, well, there's really two interesting trends that are very clear in the period that I've been studying this industry, which is about the last 20 years. As you're pointing out, on the one hand, pornography has been brought into the mainstream. It doesn't mean there aren't critics. I come out of a feminist movement that critiques it, and there are, of course, right-wing and religious critiques of pornography as well. But the culture really has embraced it to a large degree. So we have a culture that's more accepting of hardcore sexually explicit material, what we call pornography, as well as the mainstream pop culture, which is becoming more pornographic. At the same time, there's another trend in the content of the pornography in that, as you mentioned, it is more and more overtly cruel and degrading to women and also more overtly racist. In fact, it's the only mass media genre I know that still uses overtly racist stereotypes, in this case in a sexual context. And though there's a paradox in that. In the book, I talk about the paradox of pornography. We like to think of ourselves as a civilized society. If that's the case, how can a genre that is overtly misogynistic and racist become more and more accepted? And I think that paradox is important to grapple with.
And it's interesting because that is happening at the same time when there are, you know, in some ways more barriers being broken for women. You know, it is an important thing that there was a serious female contender in the Democratic primaries and that there is a female vice presidential candidate. And yet at the same time, as you said, you're seeing this other, you know, ugly underbelly of male fantasy that completely objectifies women and degrades them. And then there's also this other aspect of it, which the film covers, which is that pornography is seen as a way for women to empower themselves.
Right. There's a lot of important issues to untangle here. First of all, a lot of people have made the observation that the increases in opportunity for women, especially in business, education, politics, has provoked a certain amount of male resentment. Women are in spaces now that were once almost exclusively male. And there is a backlash theory that, in fact, one of the ways that men have responded to that is by claiming a more intense control over those spaces they still have, which many of which are about sexuality. So in some sense, it's perhaps not surprising that as women have made some minor but important gains in these areas, there has been that very sexist, misogynistic backlash in the area of sexuality. I think that's really crucial. One place we did see it is, of course, in the presidential campaign. Now, I'm not a supporter of Hillary Clinton. I don't think she's ever taken a feminist position nor advocated for a feminist view of the world. But the fact is she was the victim of very, very ugly sexist attacks, and those should be denounced. The same with Sarah Palin. You might imagine I'm not a big supporter of the worldview or political proposals of Sarah Palin. But I think within maybe 24, 48 hours after her the announcement of her selection as John McCain's running mate, somebody sent me a link to a website for this so-called VPILF, which is a takeoff on a popular genre in pornography called MILF, MILF, which stands for Mothers I'd Like to Do Things That You Can't Talk About on Radio. And, you know, the way in which this culture immediately sexualizes this candidate in the context of a pornography industry that is relentlessly misogynistic and racist, and the way in which the culture kind of shrugs about it, I think is very important. It tells us something about just how civilized we really are.
And on the one hand, the McCain campaign has accused the Obama campaign of being sexist, which I'm not sure I've actually seen any sexist rhetoric or imagery or words coming out of the Obama campaign formally. No. But they have not commented on this.
Yeah.
You know, and also there's another aspect to this, which is the controversy around Sarah Palin's wardrobe costs. I mean, these were $150,000 of money spent by the Republican National Committee to primp her up, you know, to dress her up.
Yes. Of course, you know, as politics becomes more of a marketing question, you know, we have controversies over John Edwards' haircuts and Sarah Palin's wardrobes. We should be attentive to the way in which there's still a sexist pattern in all of this, that the appearance of women and the sexuality of women, of course, is always much more on stage than men. But all of this, I think, does speak to a way in which we are in a cultural crisis. I spoke earlier in the previous segment about an economic crisis, a political crisis, and a very serious ecological crisis. But I think we're also in a cultural crisis of sorts. One, I think the left liberal progressive end of the spectrum often stays away from this subject because it has been so identified with right-wing and religious critiques. But I think we should, as a movement broadly defined as progressive, with values around the inherent dignity and equality of all people, we should be willing to call out and critique those cultural forms, in this case, the pornography industry, which present to the public, in this case to an overwhelmingly male public, in a sexual context, misogyny and racism. Why is it that the progressive movement can't condemn that? There are lots of reasons I think people are afraid to do it, but I think we have to step up and take this issue, in some sense, take it away from the right and that overly moralistic and religious framework that they present.
The Price of Pleasure, Pornography, Sexuality, and Relationships is the name of the documentary. It's directed and produced by Miguel Picker and Ching Sun. And my guest, Robert Jensen, is the senior consultant for the film. Now, where can listeners get a hold of the film? I know it's being distributed by the Media Education Foundation, but is it being shown? Is it being screened anywhere? Yeah.
Many of your listeners probably are aware of the really good work the Media Education Foundation has done over the years, important critiques of the way media are often misogynist, racist, critiques of the political coverage. And so the film right now is being distributed through the Media Education Foundation at the institutional rate. It's not yet available for consumer purchases, but we are starting to screen the film around. There is a website, thepriceofpleasure.com, which lists screenings. And in fact, Saturday evening here in the L.A. area, I'm supposed to be screening the film. I say supposed to be because there's some controversy around this. We were scheduled to screen the film at Fuller Theological Seminary in Pasadena at 7 p.m. on Saturday, and there was some controversy. Not so much, I think, because of the position the film takes, but just this fear in the culture of walking into this issue. So if anybody's interested, as far as I know, the screening is still on, although you know how institutional politics are. People can if they want to, attend that screening. The probably easiest way to find out about its status would be to email me. If people go online and put my name into Google, the first page that comes up is my homepage, and there's an email address here, and I'd be happy to respond to people.
And that's Robert Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N. Finally, in the last couple of minutes of this conversation, you mentioned the position that the left has taken, the position that the left has taken is the position that the pornographers have taken, which is that pornography should be protected as free speech. I mean, this extends to trying to protect child pornography.
There are, some controversies around this, to say the least, on the left. The position that I'm advocating in the book I just published and that the film tries to explore is not an argument for a particular public policy. Right now, the one thing that I would agree with the pornography industry on is that obscenity law, the current criminal law that governs sexually explicit material, is a violation of the First Amendment and is bankrupt. I agree. Feminist movements have put forward alternatives under the rubric of civil rights law. I think there's a lot of possibility in that. But right now, all I'm asking, and all my colleagues in the feminist movement are asking, is that the culture come to terms with the fact that we live in a society which has embraced an openly misogynistic and racist sexual form.
The priceofpleasure.com is the website that you can find out more about the film. My guest has been Robert Jensen, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and author of several books. Thank you so much for joining us in studio.
It's always great to be here. Thanks, Sonali.
And for Sonali, subversive thought for the day, Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "True peace is not merely the absence of tension. It is the presence of justice." That's MLK, and that's Sonali, subversive thought for the day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website at kpfk.org/uprising. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.